Welcome to a podcast on Fire and the Dynasty Report on the taking of Tiger Mountain 3D and Undercover Duet. And it's time to receive and listen to the gang submit another Dynasty Report. And this is the sub-series of Podcast on Fire, where I usually sit back and listen to my knowledgeable friends who still follow recent Hong Kong / Hong Kong mainland cinema with passion and interest, and they talk of how it's all been shaped for audiences of today. It's certainly not the 80s, certainly not the 90s, whether talking new or veteran filmmakers in charge, that is. And in the case of these two movies, we have that very thing. A new film from a veteran director using very modern and commercial techniques. And in the other corner, one who's only racked up 3 movies so far, including a sequel to his first movie. So the movies in question are Choi Hak's Taking of Tiger Mountain 3D and Mark Wu's Undercover Duet. And with me to discuss the pros and cons of these recent productions are Paul Fox. So say hi, first of all, buddy.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Dr. David Lam, say hi.
Howdy.
Yeah, he's psyched for taking a Tiger Mountain. Yay! Or is he? Well, we'll see what happens. In the timeline, whether it might be a month later after this recording, but in the timeline, the Lunar New Year, I think, just has passed. And I just want to ask because I'm curious. So if we start with you, Paul, did you catch all movies that you wanted to catch during this, what seemed like a fairly busy season of Lunar New Year movies?
Yes, I did. It wasn't too packed. We had, I think, in total 3 Hong Kong films and a couple Hollywood films.
Wait, it maybe just seemed packed because you sort of listed a lot that you wanted to see. Maybe that's the different vibe I got, that you wanted to see these, like look forward to see some of these anyway.
Yeah, it was a good year, I would say. Better than some, although there was a dog in the race, but we will talk about that perhaps on a future episode of the Dynasty Report.
Totally not related to anything that the legends of yesteryear and today were involved with. Chai Fat, Andy Lau, Jackie Chan, Wong Jing. So yeah, it was a good verdict. And hey, you even came out praising one. You expect Solo Lunar New Year to be, yeah, good fun, it's okay. But you came out praising one of the movies, and it was a sequel to boot. Monkey King 2, you really dug.
Mm-hmm. Yes. To be fair, I am biased on that particular title. It is one of my favorite pieces of mythology, but I think that they really raised their game when the director Soi Chung approached this, got a lot more money, had a lot more freedom and flexibility. Didn't have to work with Donnie this time. Maybe that's important or not. I'm not sure. But they ended up producing a very entertaining piece of film.
Was it disruptive at all to have, because Aaron, who's the Monkey King now, appeared in the first one, right? So is another actor playing his character from movie 1 while he's now playing the Monkey King? And is that totally confusing or just par for the course with Hong Kong?
For people who love continuity and consistency like I do, it is a little bit jarring. But when you see an improvement based on what came before, I'm able to look past it. And really the only true connection we have in terms of a appearance on screen from the first film is the role of Kelly Chen as Guanyin.
David, in your neck of the woods, you've been in Canada and all, does any theaters show Lunar New Year movies during the season? Because I sort of half assume that you have a Chinatown somewhat nearby, or what's the dealio during that time of the year?
There used to be a theater there, but it closed about, I don't know, 15 years ago. So no, we don't actually have any Hong Kong films in theaters. Like it's not common. Once in a while you'll get a premiere at a casino or something just to, you know, attract the crowd, but that's about it.
Yeah, so you have to rely on the home video format, if you will, or a download if it becomes available before you buy it later, if it's a movie that you're looking forward to. I mean any of the Lunar New Year movies, were you looking forward to anything except that one that we won't name? Like, I know you're psyched for it. I mean, there's always that it might be good this year. The blowjobs might happen.
I don't think so. I'm not even gonna put myself out there anymore. I'm pretty sure that sequel's not gonna be great. So I'm just gonna not watch it. But I will say, after listening to Paul talk about the Monkey King, it actually got me a little interested, because I had no desire to watch the sequel.
Aaron, man, that's enough for me though.
despite my my love for Aaron.
Is he totally buried in that makeup, or can you make out that that is indeed our beloved Aaron?
No, you can tell it's him a bit more so than the makeup and the suit that they had Donnie in, I think, in the first one. They've kind of toned it back, scaled it back, made him a little bit more human-esque in terms of the suit. But I think it looks better. It's just a better designed suit than from the first one.
Right on. And you can all listen to that episode on East Screen or West Screen. You'll get to plug that in a short bit. I just have a question. Do you fear, I mean, I kind of know the answer, but for context, do you fear that the cinema, this is show is named after the dynasty, now that other cinemas are closing? I heard you talk of that. Is that cinema nearing any danger of being closed, or it's set? It's solid?
Well, it's hard to say. We don't think so, because they actually just renovated the screens.
Oh, so it's not brown stained anymore?
Yeah, they don't have the brown stained panel anymore.
This is not the dynasty,
oh,
guys.
Jesus.
So I was saying the last time we were there, it's almost not the same experience anymore, because the image actually looks good. So when you're watching a really sort of B movie up there, you lose a bit of the sort of the cultural nostalgia that we had for that cinema. So I think if it was really going anywhere in the very near future, they wouldn't have spent the money to renovate and bring in new screens.
Time for you to plug, because we mentioned East Screen, West Screen, and for people who do not know, it's your podcast, and what do you do over there primarily?
Well, myself and my co-host Kevin Ma, we get together, we talk about local films for the most part. We occasionally will touch up on a Hollywood film, but most of our focus is on Hong Kong stuff, and we just try and put our perspective on it and make it entertaining.
Yep, and you certainly do it very well. And you provide that news breakdown too, which is good for me, who don't follow any news. And I also have trouble recognizing new entertainment profiles. I don't follow them as intensely as I did before. So it sort of gives me a little bit insight into what's going on, and that no one has a normal English name anymore. They're Jelly, they're Teddy, they're what's like they're not called. They just have a letter in their name. I don't know. I'm B, you know, starring B. It's like go with normal names, dude. I mean, Norman and Richard and Donald, and just make it easier for me. Don't be special with me, and don't add any Z's or X's at the end of it. Just be normal, damn it.
Or babies. Baby seems to be the new.
That was the one I was struggling for. What was her damn name? Like
Angela Baby. You've got a male actor named Baby John Choi.
Oh, stop it.
Yep. So, yep. Baby John. My favorite.
At least Dominic has a Dominic alike. Dominic Ho. I mean, there's no need to. He didn't go like, I'm Bro Ho or anything. Like, just because I'm in Bro 5 or add a 5 to his name. No, I'm Dominic. I'm an actor. I was in that movie that plenty of people like. Respect to him. Okay, where's the URL to your podcast, Paul?
You can find us over at Kongcast.com. That's KONGCAST.com.
And I recommend tuning in, because it's a weekly breakdown, as a set of news, recent reviews, and a very easily appreciated and consumed format. I mean, I really dig the sort of hour-long look that you have every week. It really does make sense. So I think you hit a good formula blend for your show. So good on you. Well done, you and Kevin. Right on, and we'll do some quick contact information before we get into the taking of Tiger Mountain 3D. There's a lot of T's in there, so just call it Tiger 3D or something. But anyway, this is the Dynasty Report within the show, Podcast on Fire on podcastonfire.com. We have a Podcast on Fire network. You have plenty of other shows to choose from, including bonus episodes. Email us if you have any feedback on these new movies, if you've been to the Dynasty, or any kind of question or feedback you might have. The email address is podcastonfire@googlemail.com, and if you go to the site, you'll see handy buttons leading to our social media, Facebook, Twitter, as well as our iTunes feed, which you can subscribe to and rate and even leave a comment on. And you can also stream us on Stitcher Radio if you don't want to download podcasts to your device. I write about not many new movies, but plenty of old Hong Kong movies, Taiwanese movies, ninja movies, and a variety of both kiddie-friendly material and not-so-kiddie-friendly material over at my site, sogoodreviews.com. And I do little video reviews as well on sleazykvideo.com, and my Twitter handle is @sogoodreviews. That is us, I think. So let's take a short promotional break and let the guys sing high praises or not, as the case might be, for the taking of Tiger Mountain 3D by Choi Hak from last year. From 2014. It's 2016 now. So sit tight for a little while, listen to a podcast promo break, and we'll be back.
The following message is a paid advertisement for the Cult of Muscle podcast. The Cult of Muscle. You're either in it or you're dead.
It's the dawning of a new age. The halls of Valhalla have been shuttered. The heroes of yore have either retreated to the shadows or taken to capering for the amusement of the small folk, their past glories a distant memory. The barbells have been torn from their once puma-strong grips. The beards shorn from their square jaws, only to be transplanted onto flannel-clad, puny weaklings with fingers barely powerful enough to strum a ukulele. The time has come, my brothers, to restore order from the chaos. No longer will our heroes be forgotten. No longer will their great deeds be viewed through a foggy lens of irony. Hear now our rallying cry as we scream it from the mountaintops, as we bellow it from iTunes and Libsyn and Facebook. It's time to join the cult, my brothers. So don your cloaks and enter the Cult of Muscle.
And welcome back, and I'm going to shut up for a little while and listen mostly to the guys talk back and forth about Choi Hak's, is it to date is still his latest film, right? He's working on The Miracle Fighters, I know, but what's this? Yeah, it seems like this is the last film he fully directed. I mean, there's a 2017 listing for something that does not have an English title that Stephen Chow is set to write, apparently, but that might just be a rumors that still generated a Hong Kong movie database entry. I don't know. But the plot, first of all, and Paul, why don't you break down for us what The Taking of Tiger Mountain 3D is about?
So the plot, as written by our good friends over at lovehkfilm.com, based on a novel-turned-patriotic opera set in 1946, Tiger Mountain details the exploits of a small People's Liberation Army troop who defend a northern China village from a dastardly army of bandits. Led by Serious Captain 203, the brigade should be fighting the Kuomintang, but end up doing so indirectly as the bandits are in cahoots with the KMT, and they fight the PLA on their behalf while also terrorizing local villagers. So the story itself is based on a semi-real tale, and this film kind of puts it into a pseudo-real perspective. There's quite a bit, I wouldn't say high fantasy going on, but there's some fantasy aspects put in with the inclusion of fictional characters and an ending that just kind of left me scratching my head. And I'll get into that with the discussion with David in just a moment. To give a brief summary, though, this is kind of like a heist film, or for those who are familiar with a lot of the World War II films, I'm thinking films like The Dirty Dozen or Guns of Navarone, you know, these sort of long, epic, high-action films with a pretty big cast, and there's also a lot of sort of rah-rah nationalism as a kind of undercurrent that's going on. That's what this film is designed to be. It does have sort of Choi Hak's flair for it. His sense of style, his sense of design are present within the film. But for me, despite the fact that this has great production values, really high production values, and it's got a really interesting look, it's still way too long of a film. And it really kind of pushed my buttons because of the length. There were just long sections that I felt not a lot was going on. They introduced quite a few characters. It's kind of hard to keep up with a lot of the people because you're not really sure. I guess if you're somebody who's familiar with the opera or you're familiar with other literature on this event, then a lot of this will make more sense to you. But for me, I think a lot of it just lacked the sense of dynamic characterizations that something like a heist film, because at its core, that's what this is. It's a kind of heist film. It's like an Ocean's 11, but you end up kind of trying hard, so hard to keep track of who's who throughout the course of the film and who's on which side. Ultimately, by the time you get to the end, you're not really clear on a lot of there's pretty much one guy two guys you're supposed to support, but the things that happen to other people kind of get just pushed to the wayside because they happen so quickly. A character comes on and something happens and you're just not sure, you know, of the impact of that. So, yeah, I want to throw it over to David to give his two cents, his short two cents on his thoughts on it.
Well, I think Tiger Mountain actually had two things going against it for me. Full disclosure, I'm not a big fan of war dramas in general. It's just not my thing. And secondly, I was pretty sick during the first viewing, so it kind of skewed my opinion on the movie a little bit. I agree with Paul. I did have a lot of problems trying to figure out who's fighting who. There's no real identity to the units. I mean, there's a lot of faces, but you don't generally get a sense who these people are. Then I just, after a while, I just gave myself to, just gave in and just decided to, you know, just allow the movie to be what it was. And I was confused. I was intrigued. And in fact, intrigued enough to watch it a second time. And the second time, I will tell you, I was actually quite entertained, and I end up actually liking this movie quite a bit.
Interesting. I mean, normally when a movie sort of isn't connecting with you that first time, it takes a lot to get in there again, whether going to the cinema or putting it, you know, playing the disc again or streaming it again. Even that is, you know, an effort. And I mean, considering it's long, I mean, are we talking 120, 140, or is it even more epic?
I think it's a little bit over 2 hours, right, Paul?
Yeah. Yeah, the version I watched was. So I think mine was, if I clocked it right, was kind of in between 2 and 2.5 hours. Anything that pushes over 2 hours for me tends to be a bit of a marathon race. And
yep.
I actually had to take this piecemeal.
We're all super old that way. Like, we can only do a half an hour at a time sometimes. Like, I gotta go to bed now.
But that's the thing. Like, with some films, if it catches me in the right way, I'm very happy to ride it out.
Totally.
It won't seem like it's a, you know, a 2+ hour investment. But this one, I could just kind of tell right from the start, because it starts in present day with this character kind of going back to his village in China. Yeah. And getting in touch with his quote unquote communist revolutionary roots, I guess, as it were. beyond that, it's not really preachy. You know, this isn't founding of a republic. It's not, like I said, just like any American war movie is going to have that sense of nationalism as a kind of undercurrent. Mm-hmm. You know, that's here, but it's not, you know, in your face kind of love the party kind of thing. It's really just trying to do that. And I appreciated it for that. You know, Choi Hark is here. He's trying to build this kind of a genre, you know, the old sort of epic war movies that were hero movies. They weren't like the modern films of today with movies like, I want to say, Saving Private Ryan and others, which they kind of kick that hero aspect of war to the side. It's much less about the action and it's more about the human drama and the death and the despair. Here, I think that you've got this presence of mind to make the epic action films of old, like Hollywood at one time used to do. So it's interesting to see China pushing into that direction with its film. And I think that as a director, Choi Hark is one of the right people to do it because he knows epic action. Where I think the film, again, falls short is the characterizations just aren't as vivid as I think they could be. There's not enough separation between who you're supposed to root for and who's interesting. A lot of the characters are archetypal. You've got, you know, the big heavy character. You've got the commander type character. Of course, there's a kid. There's a Revolutionary War nurse who comes in. So a lot of this are archetypes we've seen before and other stuff. They're just not that well developed. Could this film have been better served with maybe some larger star power outside of the mainland China star? We have one big Hong Kong star, but pretty much everybody else is mainland China stars that I don't think a lot of people who don't follow mainland China films specifically will know, recognize, or identify with.
Yeah, I didn't recognize anybody.
Well, you know, sometimes it isn't the recognition factor that is needed, but indeed that character recognition factor that there's something to hook onto with movies, right? Like, so you can have newcomers in there, but if you do it well and present recognizable character traits and not dumbing it down, but they just have a few hooks here and there rather than sort of anonymous factor running through the character gallery. Then you can totally get away with presenting this to audiences who are not into or do not know the actors on display here. Is the Hong Kong actor's appearance, is that a spoiler thing, so one shouldn't say who's the big Hong Kong actor that's also in this movie?
Well, he's up for an award.
But is it like, and the bad guy is, here I am.
Well, they do kind of do a very slow reveal. He doesn't show up until an hour in to this, mm-hmm. 2 hour plus thing. And I went into this movie, I know that this actor is in this film. Where is he? I haven't seen him.
He's pretty unrecognizable.
We'll just leave it at that then. But, if I knew he was in there, I would have lasted for longer. So full disclosure, listeners, even though this is not very interesting, I tried. God knows I tried. But here's the problem, and this is purely my fault. This is a 3D movie. And I posed this question to you guys while I rant for just a few sentences. So is 3D for this movie just a tacked on gimmick? Or does it work with this more rural and gritty in feel type of story? At least that's what I saw. A lot of fighting in the snow and, despair a little bit. But from what I saw during that first half hour, those slowed down shots where the camera pan around the action as bullets, in bullet time, hit people and the CJ blood comes splashing onto the screen, or not onto as such, but, there are 3D elements, therefore CG elements. I just could not take it. I am too much of a traditional, again, this is my fault, viewer where I just can't take, in 98% of the cases, computer-generated blood. Because we're not talking that this is a big fantasy cartoon where it could be warranted. No, this is supposed to be, a little bit more of a slice of real life. It isn't a fantasy, and therefore that CJ blood as the camera pans around and therefore doing the 3D gimmick thing is just completely dull to me. I can't get excited by that stuff, guys, and I'm clearly the wrong audience for it, too. So I tried. God knows I tried. I mean, I wasn't... That first half hour, it wasn't sinking its hooks into me as such, because it probably hadn't started properly. But I had, three valiant attempts at getting past those 3D segments where they shoot back and forth and it goes really, really slow. And I just couldn't. I mean, without the 3D, in my opinion, I think it would have had a chance, because the setting and the tone felt to me like the least likely movie to have 3D connected to it, And again, I'm not here. I can't really judge the movie. Therefore, I can't present an actual opinion because I didn't finish the damn thing. But I just couldn't. I just couldn't finish it. So I posed the question. Let me start to you, David. With you, David, is the 3D justified or just a tacked-on gimmick for it? And did you therefore get past that inclusion the second time around? So what did you think?
Well, I watched it on the iPad, and I can only imagine it would be a pretty awesome spectacle, like watching it in 3D, because I mean,
but doesn't it take you out of the moment? I mean, those moments are completely Matrix to me.
Not for me. I mean, it made the movie interesting. I mean, because it does have that Trey Hark feel to it. I mean, at certain times you feel like you're almost watching like a wuxia. There's some generic 3D stuff where, there are bullets and daggers and grenades flying at you, but he also plays around with the perspective and space of it. And it becomes really interesting. I wish I could have watched it on 3D. I thought, he was quite playful with some of the framing.
Yeah, it's the CG blood thing, man. I mean, I'll give it to him. Maybe the sort of playful visuals would have got me, but it's the CG blood, man. It's just, I can't stand it.
The CG blood is used pretty sparingly, though. I don't remember there being that much.
Well, for the first half hour, seeing three bursts of it in three different sequences didn't spell like, it spelled out like, I'm going to get 2 hours of this. No, never. So I watched a crappy movie instead, obviously, because this is my problem. This is my fault, obviously. Paul, 3D justified for this, or just a tacked-on gimmick for Tiger Mountain?
Now you should know me by now, sir. You're preaching to the choir.
I'm not trying to preach, though. I'm not trying to preach.
There's only one movie I ever felt 3D was used in an innovative manner, and that's Avatar. Everything after that's been tacked on. I give it a pass in animated films, you know, cartoons. I think it works for me pretty well there. There's not a movie that I think I've seen since Avatar where I would say, oh, absolutely, this must be in 3D. It works so much better in 3D. There just hasn't. I think it's a gimmick. I think, you know, especially for myself, I hate wearing glasses. It darkens down the movie. If I have a 2D option, that's what I'm going to go to. So,
did you therefore catch this in the cinemas when it was out?
No, this was one that something about it, maybe the length and nothing in the trailer really kind of spoke to me at the time. So it came and went. It was a late release too for us over here, where it had gotten play in China much, much earlier. I just remember it was during a busy time. I didn't get out to see it.
Full disclosure, am I the only one who just can't stand CJ blood for basic squib effects? You know, they're not rigging up actors with little gunpowder packets anymore. I think that's just an indicator of modern cinema. That means I'm not the audience for modern cinema anymore. I just can't take it, especially when you're talking action movies. I mean, God forbid when John Woo does his next heroic bloodshed movie, that the remake of the Japanese movie Manhunt. I don't know if the Japanese movie was called that, but I think John's movie is called Manhunt. Now, God forbid he does what he did with Hardboiled and The Killer, but does CJ squibs instead, because then I'm out.
It's just a case of getting the right special effects coordinator to do it. Because I've seen movies that use squibs in a terrible way.
Sure.
Let me just use a current example. Deadpool. I think that they were using CG blood in Deadpool, but it looked really good. And the only reason I say this, and I could be completely wrong, it might have been a combination, is that they're able to release a 2D version or a 2B version and a 3 version, and I've seen a trailer where it looks like they're just able to not generate as much blood in like some headshots and things. So I'm thinking that there's in some cases some flexibility there in production and post-production as to if you need to scale it back because you're trying to fit something into a certain category or not. Whereas if you're doing the practical effect, then you've got to actually pay somebody to go in post and clean it up. But I think that it can be done well in both platforms, and it can be done poorly in both platforms. The problem is, I think most filmmakers who are going the CG route, they're you know, doing it because they're trying to save on costs. And ultimately, they're going to a production house that's not doing very good CG work for the blood.
Mm-hmm. I can remember the sole example that where I think it was where I wasn't taken out of the movie. And granted, I wasn't a huge fan of the movie, but it was all right. But I liked the way it was used in Dredge.
Mm.
All right. I mean, it's a comic book movie, yes, but it's not a big cartoony fantasy or anything. It's you know, gritty, dark violence. But I think that was, despite being very slow motion in style, They sort of justified it with a plot, I think, because I think the drugs that were taken in that movie made everything slow down. But still, it looked better than I'm used to. So that, I gave that a pass, and the movie was all right, too. So there's a tiger on the posters. Does this mean this movie becomes really, really big and stuff, or is the Tiger Mountain just a Tiger Mountain?
There's a tiger in the movie.
So it really goes from that more rural sort of war drama to something way, way bigger by hour two? Or what's the dealio there to give listeners and me an insight into what happens? So what do you say, Paul?
I think somebody said, hey, let's do a CG tiger. Chase a guy up a tree for no reason. Because that whole plot device that they used that scene for could have been totally done without the tiger, without that. I don't think it looked very good. I think it was just tacked on extra time that could have been saved if they just said, hey, the guy got captured. That's it. You know, take him to the stronghold. But no, they had this whole CG tiger, and they're learning, you know, that they've got to do this kind of stuff to learn. And that's good. But sometimes it just seems like unnecessary. That whole scene just felt unnecessary to me.
Yeah, I agree. The tiger scene was pretty unnecessary, but I also found it pretty awesome. It's like that, I don't know if you guys have seen The Revenant, but it's like the Leo fight against the bear, but on a lesser scale. I found it pretty exciting. You know, the tiger didn't look that convincing, but Hey, I mean,
he got recast in the Monkey Kingdom too.
And the thing is, this movie, it is long, and then you'll go through stretches where nothing happens, but then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there'll be like this sequence with a tiger, and you're reinvested in the movie again. The entire movie was like that for me. I mean, you'd have to sit through these long stretches, but then, you know, you'd always know that something awesome was about to happen. So that was okay for me.
When all is said and done, what was Choi Hark aiming for? A mixture of character and commercialism, the heist movie kind of thing, or is it designed to be easily consumed, kind of popcorn movie style? You know what I mean? So what's your verdict on that, David?
I think he was going for fluff, but I mean, good fluff. There are bookends to this movie that absolutely make no sense. You know, if it was someone aside from Choi Hark that was doing this movie, they would have cut it out. Like, it wouldn't have made it past the cutting. Choi Hark being Choi Hark, I mean, there's something almost idiosyncratic about the way he makes films. Like, there's no mistaking a Choi Hark film, right? And I really feel like, in his mind, this is his popcorn movie.
The sad thing about all this is that if he'd made this movie in the 90s, back when you had a very vibrant Category 3 genre of films being made here, somebody would have come along, you know, some Category 3 director would have come along, you know, a month or 2 months later and made, you know, made it something called the Taking of Tiger's Mountain or something.
Or Penis Mountain.
Yeah, they would have just, you know, it would have been one of those things that kind of got riffed on and become more of a part of pop culture, I think. But the industry's changed so much now that what they're doing here is, you know, he's trying to build up the war movie in a kind of way it's touching on pop culture, it's touching on history, but it's not something that's really familiar to the outside world. So therein lies the problem. He hasn't gone to a lot of recognizable stars, and so really he's creating this thing that's, I think it's divisive, like we were talking about before we started recording. And I think that it's one of those things that he's not intending it for the international audience as much as he's intending it for the home audience or the people who know the story, who are familiar with the opera. And the opera, it takes a kind of role itself, because when the credits roll, you see he has some footage of the opera actually playing, which I thought
even
was a
in
very
the
nice
beginning
touch.
Too.
Very nice touch for that.
I almost feel like that Tiger's sequence might be an homage to the opera, but I'm not certain.
It could be. Yeah, I'm not that familiar with the opera. I am familiar with some of the other PLA style musical operas, such as The East is Red or Red Detachment of Women. And I think that turning those kinds of things into movies that are entertaining, that aren't so in your face about the party and the whole sort of communist manifesto kind of thing, I think here's where this movie is very successful, because again, it's basically that simple idea that you've got this group of sort of honest, good soldiers, you've got peasants, you know, the oppressed in the middle, and you've got these bad guy warlords. You've seen, I'm sure, half a dozen other China movies who've taken this and beaten that kind of dynamic into the ground with nationalist sentiment. And so he's kind of taken a lot of that out, and he's put in it's in a lot of style. It's just, for me, it's a lot of style, not quite as much substance as I'd like.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with sort of being swept away by empty spectacle. You know, it doesn't need sometimes to be filled with characteristics and deep characteristics. But, you know, it needs to be good spectacle too. You know, that sweeps you away and sort of makes the 2 hours fly by. And it seems created like that, as David stated, but it seems like it wasn't, sweep you off your feet. I mean, you did have to watch it in like two sittings at least, Paul. So that says something about how it impacted you personally.
And I think for me, we mentioned that like an hour in, a certain Hong Kong actor shows up. From that point, I really started to get a little bit more interested in the film. That's when things really start to happen in a much more dynamic manner. And it just felt like that's where they could have actually started the film, that I really didn't need that first hour or so of buildup necessarily. But the interesting thing is that by the time we do get through a lot of that, we get into the more of the action pieces, then it gets to this ending, which I can only describe as kind of anticlimactic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so anticlimactic that they actually come out on the film and say, yeah, that's kind of what happened, but wouldn't it have been so much more interesting if this is what happened? And it goes back in time and retells the ending of the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It as like this total fantasy, this total like James Bond style, as I think Kozo refers to it, this whole James Bond style action sequence.
Which sounds like it's making a parody statement of some sort. Like, here's what really could have happened.
I mean, I certainly get what Chirhark is doing, but it seems like it's the wrong movie to be doing it.
Because you mentioned playful. Is this having too much fun, therefore?
It almost seems too meta for a movie that's pretty intent on pleasing and going the conventional route.
If you really want to get a sense of this, okay, there's several different posters for this film out there. And yeah, no, there's a series of posters out here, different posters for the film. And one of the posters has this thing on it. I don't want to spoil it. You can go out and look at it and then watch the film and you'll see exactly what. But one of the posters has this thing. And the whole movie, I'm thinking, where's this thing? I haven't seen this thing.
What's the thing, damn it?
It's not in the movie. Why was it on the poster? Where's this thing? And then suddenly they go through this, well, what if this happened? You know, it was almost like a Wayne's World kind of thing where, you know, they came up.
Scooby-Doo ending.
Exactly. And then there's that thing. And I'm like, oh, okay, I get it now. And it's just so weird in the context of what the storytelling that they are doing, as David said, that you just don't expect them to do this. And then it gets even more weird because now correct me if I'm wrong, David, because I don't remember. Is this... I like the idea of the Scooby-Doo ending. Does that happen after the dinner table scene with all the guys? Or is that the very last thing?
The dinner table scene happens first, and then
Yeah. So it's like there's this weird moment of this like dinner table scene that brings the context of, like I said, it starts in modern day, mm-hmm. right, of this guy going back to sort of find his roots. And then it brings the story, the old historic story, into the present day. And then, then they could go back and do but wouldn't it be great if this happened, right? The Hollywood style ending. Mm-hmm. And it's just so weird.
Yeah.
And again, it's adding additional time to this already sort of lengthy thing. But the irony is that when you see the actual, or what I guess they're saying is the actual ending, again, because there are parts of this that are based on historical people that you kind of go, that's it. You know, that's what, you know, that's anticlimactic. Mm-hmm. And I think he's like, yeah, that's anticlimactic. So let me give him a big...
History sucks. Like, movies rule. You know, let me ask you this. I mean, it's not like we're at the tail end of the discussion, but I want to get your idea of this. Is Chirhark, who's led... effects and genre revolutions several times. Is he adjusting well to today's modern cinema? I mean, this is not a groundbreaking film, so it's not like that's his aim here. But is he adjusting well to modern cinema? If we start with you, Paul, I mean, does he have a place in today's like mainland cinema and Hong Kong cinema?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, stylistically, there's nobody like him. And so even for a film like this, which some people could again say this is a quote-unquote red film, it's not. It's Chirhark blue, if I could put a color tone on it, right? You know, because if you go back and look at a lot of his films going all the way back to like Zoo and stuff, he's got this kind of blue aspect to his films, not blue in the Category 3 sense, but just kind of a tonal thing. So yeah, I think this is very much him, and it's very much him, again, trying to push the genre in ways that people haven't seen before. This is not a film that I think is for everybody. I'm still not sure this film is for me necessarily, but in the scope of what he's done recently, we've got this film, we've got things like, Detective D. I loved Detective D.
I really liked that too. Yeah. It almost seemed to me, pardon me, like it was going to be something I couldn't penetrate because it looked big, and it wasn't. I mean, it was a murder mystery. which made me like, ah, okay, I like it. It's cool. And the visuals were all fun and fine because of the setting and all of that. Not seeing the young Detective D, because I just thought, like, why go that route? I want more of that guy, older guy. Andy Lau, what are you doing?
My thoughts exactly. And so something like this comes along, I'm like, okay, but you could have given me more Andy Lau and Detective D. You know, so that's just my own personal preference. But I do think that in the scope of the work he's doing very good work, high quality work, tonally. He's contributing to the genre. He's trying to expand the genre. And so you might not fully enjoy this film to the scope of which you've enjoyed his other works, but I think it's still a significant contribution.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he remains like one of the more interesting directors working today. I think you'll find that he's always been very good with dealing with action and coming up with like clever stylistic devices. Pacing and storytelling has never been his strong suit. And I think you find that in his old movies and you find that in his new movies. I mean, it's just, you know, he's not wired that way. I mean, he's always going to be the director that's more interested in the visual aspects of filmmaking rather than storytelling, I think.
It's certainly become that way, though. I think you could argue in the beginning, he, even post-Zoo, he had a little period where he did this more earthy movies. I mean, there's a reason Shanghai Blues and Working Class are some of my favorite movies by him. I sort of enjoy when Choi Hak sort of just strips it down and makes a fluffy, sweet little movie with people only. But you're right, like they're normally, you know, spectacles in some way or another, and usually enjoyable visual spectacles, you know, Green Snake, The Lovers, and stuff like that.
Yeah. I would like to bring the conversation back to the casting of this big Hong Kong actor. I mean, I found it so distracting.
Despite it being him?
Yeah, but he looks like he just came out of some Harry Potter convention or something. You have a movie with, like, virtually unknowns to me, and then you cast this guy who's supposedly, like, who's recognizable, but you cover him up with prosthetics, and he just looks weird. Like, he looks like he should be in some sort of fantasy film rather than, a war drama. It's just, I think that was the biggest issue I had with the movie.
I'm on the opposite camp with David, because I enjoyed his look. He looked very much like a comic book character, basically. A big comic book villain. And because of that, again, it gets us back into this idea of this isn't just a war movie. It is trying to be sort of this war epic / somewhat fantasy-ish. So for those people who maybe, like myself, who aren't all that keen on war movies, there's still enough here tonally to keep my interest to ride it out to the end.
Well, any other notes you want to share, whether from beginning, middle, or end of movie, non-spoiler, then the floor is yours, guys. So keep the discussion going for as long as you want. So anything else you want to contribute, David?
Yeah, I think watching it, it was felt weirdly nostalgic. It almost felt like, you know, I was watching one of those old Cheng Che Shaw Brother movies.
Right on.
It's visually, it's just brilliant. It looks great. You know, the snow looks great.
It looked like they, for the few minutes that I watched, and for disclosure as well, I might just try it in 15-minute intervals and see if it gets me. Like, no, back to a crappy ninja movie instead. Phew. But it looked like, it certainly didn't look studio-bound. It was one of those, like, we're going where the cold is and where the snow is. Deal with it. Do you want to act in movies? Well.
And I know Paul brought up James Bond, and believe it or not, there's actual skiing in this movie.
Yes, I forgot about the skiing. Skiing and shooting. Okay, so it's very specific James Bond. Like, I'm trying to I think it was like one of the old Roger Moores where they're like skiing down a mountain and shooting Uzis, right? Two of the most difficult things to possibly do on the planet and combine them. And so, yeah, these guys are like just, you know, zooming around on these skis and taking shots at each other. It's great. It's a great, very James Bondian kind of scene.
And also, what we haven't mentioned is that this did well. Oh boy, did it do well on the mainland. I don't think it was like the most successful one, and then Mermaid passed it, but this was up there, box office-wise. People loved to go and see this. I don't know what the general thought in the general audiences was of the movie, but there was something here, a commercial pull that was great. in terms of big. And maybe it's the local recognition factor, or that it just had this buzz there that people just, whoa, whoa, wow, and it has this and a tiger and multiple endings and 3D. So it made a bunch of money, and whether it's that is a cue for a sequel or not, I don't know, but it certainly meant that Choi Hak did well on the mainland. Maybe his biggest hit on the mainland after a few movies.
It didn't do all that well down here. Again, we have this resistance to films that have this tie to the history, or to that are seen to have a tie to politics per se. But really, when I say that, you just don't get a strong sense of that in this film. I think that you can approach it and get entertainment out of it very, very easily without being preached to in any sense.
Yeah, you should have cast Louis Koo in it, I think.
There you go. Has he broken the mainland yet, or is he still like relying on good old Hong Kong?
Oh, Louis, no, he's just kicking himself because Donnie's in Star Wars, that's all. You know, he's crying in a corner somewhere.
Rogue One, I'll get you.
He's relegated himself to doing online promotional videos for StarWars.com.
Really? Wow, I love that. I remember posting that video that was like a sort of dance routine involving lightsabers. It was promotion for some kind of thing, whether it was for StarWars.com. And all I kept thinking of when I posted that, Saturday at Louis Koo's house. Like, this is what we're doing tonight.
At the very least, I got to hope that Donnie will get him on set and get him dressed up as a stormtrooper. They dressed up Daniel Craig as a stormtrooper. I mean, come on. This is the least you can do for Lewis. He's the biggest Star Wars geek in Hong Kong.
Yeah, so even Kevin Smith provided some brief voiceover, stormtrooper voiceover. So yeah, give the fans a break. I mean, he'll do it for free, Lewis. Yes. He'll pay to say something.
It might be a problem because you might see his tan through the white stormtrooper armor, but they'll fix it in post.
How was your holiday, Mr. Stormtrooper? Oh no, I look like this all the time. Yeah. Well, availability, there's no shortage of discs. I checked local Blu-rays, both 2D and 3D. When I say local, I mean Hong Kong. And it also has a Netflix presence in the US and Canada. And in the US, also a DVD and Blu-ray. I don't know if it has both 2D and 3D in the US, but there's no shortage of options to watch The Taking of Tiger Mountain. So, no other regions on Netflix other than US and Canada.
I would say that if you have the opportunity to go for the HD version over the standard definition, though, because it is a very it is a nice film to look at.
Did you pick it up at any point? Do you have a big 3D setup in your house as well? No, I'm just kidding. Like the wifey brought you like a 3D TV, like ta-da, and you just sink in your chair like. No. No. And the kid is like, 3D! And you're stuck until she moves out. Yeah, there it is. Well, I tried watching like that Netflix version because I'm still region switching. And I still can. I mean, Netflix have cracked down on the region switching services. My service still works. So if I do try this on again in these 5, 10, or 15 minute intervals, I can still access the US or Canadian version of it. And it is obviously subtitled too, so they didn't just put a dubbed version on there, because I'm sure someone wanted an English dub on it just for international distribution. But on Netflix it is original Mandarin, albeit I don't remember the sections I watched being sync sound, but I'm sure it's durable in terms of that aspect. We're used to it now. I mean, sync sound seems more rare nowadays, at least the movies we discuss on this show. Like, sync sound is like this revelation almost for movies. But a big spectacle, maybe they don't want to spend time getting good sound out of a spectacle like Taking of Tiger Mountain. But still, there was no excuse to have like From Vegas to Macau 1 in syncs in post dubbed form and then go sync sound for movie 2. That's just lazy. And anything else before we do the break that you want to conclude with, guys?
I think Zhang Han Yu, his character Brother Nine, is right up there with the great cinema badasses of all time. I think he's pretty awesome in it.
Yeah, an actor has a bunch of credits, but not familiar with him yet anyway. So
yeah, he really surprised me.
Right on. Okay, let's take a short podcast promotional break and move over to talking to something that has not been, buzzing as a movie as such, at least not. It wasn't on my radar. And we turned to Hong Kong for the movie Undercover Duet. And it is indeed a comedy. And we'll hear. I'm totally curious in terms of what the guys think of this, because you don't hear a lot of, Hong Kong comedies getting constant good reviews, like a string of comedies just bursting onto the scene, and they're all classics. And we'll see if this is, but I'm quite curious because it was picked for this show. I think it's for a reason, and not just because they want to take a crap on it for 40 minutes. I think it's for a reason. So we'll take a podcast promotional break, and we'll be back after that.
Yo, are you looking for a podcast that breaks movies down like you couldn't believe? I mean, takes them apart piece by piece and analyzes every little thing, getting you the most out of every movie that you ever could. Well, look no further than The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema with Samurai and Big Willie. These fuckers know how to review movies, or my name ain't the head.
You can find The Gentleman at ggtmc.com.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
And welcome back for the second half of this Dynasty Report. And this time we're going to talk off, and I'm going to listen in on this talk of a movie. I have no idea what it's about. I didn't know it existed until the guys brought it up. So I'm quite keen on hearing what Undercover Duet from 2015 is about and how it is. So, Paul, what is it about?
Ronald Chang stars as Dream Dragon, or D-Dragon, as he as his friends call him. A wacky cop who works undercover in the Triads. D-Dragon wants to get out of the sort of risky, infernal affairs life that he's currently employed in as an undercover operative. And he's asked by his superior officer to shadow James Mann, played by Mark Wu, who is also the director of the film. James Mann is an annoying professional extra and wannabe celebrity who witnesses a hit-and-run accident that he also happens to be filming at the time. The suspect is Roger Lee, the son of a wealthy tycoon, but Roger's assistant, Ho Wing Yet, ends up taking the blame instead, which sets off a kind of media frenzy and plenty of teeth gnashing. D-Dragon is childhood friends with James, and so it gives him the perfect opportunity to investigate. However, when James participates in a male beauty pageant called the Man of China, an assassin shows up, and things kind of just get crazy with violence and all kinds of chicanery. The question becomes, can D-Dragon save his pal and also get him to testify by the end of the film? So yes, it is a throwback to older Hong Kong films, we might say. It's got a little bit of everything. There's some wacky characterizations, quite a few cameos. There's a little bit of action in places, a little bit of danger at times. But for the most part, it tries to stay as lighthearted as possible. On the good side, it's fairly funny if you like Ronald Chang doing Chinglish and saying the F word a lot.
And do you?
I do.
It ticks all those boxes.
His dialogue, yeah. So it worked for me. Yeah, some classic Hong Kong cinema beats. And if you like Ronald Chang kind of doing Ronald Chang shtick, this will work for you. The bad is it kind of drags in a few places. It's about, I'd say, 20 minutes too long. And it has a couple of what I'd call false endings that we'll kind of get into as we get a bit further into the film.
Is that why you picked these two movies? Like, because they have sort of false endings, both of these movies, this and Undercover Duets?
Could be. Let me throw it back over to the doctor and I have his take on it.
All right. So, like you, Paul, I found the movie a little bit long. I mean, actually really long. For a comedy, it shouldn't be 2 hours, right? You know, like you, Ken, I didn't know anything about this movie. I had no idea who the chubby kid standing beside Ronald Chang was in the poster was. He kind of looks like a bigger Wong Chul Nam, which I didn't know how to... I don't know if that was appealing to me or not. I just wanted something in the background so I could, wouldn't be bored while I was making dinner or something. I remember watching it on the Sunday afternoon, so... I wasn't expecting much, but as soon as the movie started, Ronald Chang is hilarious. I find he's an underrated actor in general. I mean, he's underrated as a serious actor and he's underrated as a comedic actor. I think he's quite funny in this. Mark Wu, it took me a while, but I was finally able to remember where I've seen him. He's one of the cock doctors in Sex and Zen 3D.
Oh yeah, you're right. That's the guy. I know the guy now. I totally recognized him from somewhere. Or it was just that he looked like token obese comedic presence. But you're right. He's the guy who picks up the horse thing.
And aside from directing Undercover Duet, he's also the writer. And I think he's more talented as a writer than as a director. But overall, I think this movie is actually pretty funny. I give it a pass.
So let me just ask my curious questions here. Mark Wu, is there directorial promise based on this movie and his debut movie? Was it Due West or Sex Journey? So if we throw over to Paul, is there anything in Mark Wu's style and movies that you've seen that sort of spells, I like this, give me more?
I'd say based on this film, yes. Based on Due West, Our Sex Journey, no. So he's kind of in the middle. He's straddling the center line for me right now.
And he's doing a sequel, apparently, or has done it already, Due West 2.
I think that might have gone to Film Art. I don't know if it's actually gone into production or not. It's called Due West 2, Our Sex Vacation, I think. But there's been no... it had a 215 listed release, but as far as I know, it's not been released. I don't even know if it's gone into production.
I'm sorry, but the poster is genius. Not only are they driving a boat towards a female's crotch, but but the tagline is, "Let's go in-depth travel to Thailand." I'm sold. In. How sold. Is that not sold to someone? How is that not made yet? My God. Don't be like a prude about your adult movie. Like, sell it like an effing adult movie like that. That's brilliant. Make that movie. I don't care.
Credit-wise, he's popped up as an actor in a few places, mostly cameos. Aside from this film, he was in Two Thumbs Up last year. He had a cameo. And as David mentioned, 3D Sex and Zen, he also starred in his own film, Due West, as well. Writing, he's also been attached to the Lan Kwai Fong movies. And I think he also has a writing credit for last year's Imprisoned Survival Guide for the Rich and Prodigal, which was a fairly good throwback to the prison movies. So he does have a sense, I think, of a couple things. Hong Kong nostalgia. So you see him working in both the Category 3 genre, trying to get back to, I think, some of that sensibility of the old Category 3 films. I think, Ken, you'd probably, if you've seen Due West or not, I'm not sure, but
nope.
You'd probably have a better idea. Once you see that film, you'll have a better idea whether you think he's successful.
It sort of depends, by the way, if you go for it, like if you... We talked about this on the Gigolo podcast, sort of what current Hong Kong movies are doing for Category 3, and some are just content with flirting with it and not even getting that rating. So I like when movies like the Gigolo just, let's just go for it. We have the rating, play. But there's sort of a reluctant factor there that society has changed somewhat, so this is maybe frowned upon to do, rude movies like this. I don't know how far Due West goes or anything. If it's
pretty full on Category 3 for what you expect. I just don't know if he's got, at least for the Category 3 genre, he's got the sense of playfulness that films, at least the kind of Category 3 films that would get me interested, like 33D Invader, mm-hmm. and some others that have that sense of, playful, kind of tongue-in-cheekness to them,
mm-hmm.
that I think are some, not overly indicative of the genre, but at least a part of the genre that, because you do have the darker side of the Category 3 genre too. There, so he's got that angle. With this film, he's kind of going a little bit more towards the action comedy films of the, I'd say, the mid to early 90s. He has this sense of nostalgia. He knows film, again, because he was a writer on Imprisoned. That film is also kind of touching on the prison film genre a little bit. So he knows film, and I think he's got his finger on the pulse of old film and trying to bring that into a more modern context for a younger audience. Now, whether other audience members will think he's as successful as at least I do for this film, not for the Category 3 film per se. We'll have to wait and see, and we'll see what David says too.
Yeah, so yay or nay for Mark Wu based on these two movies. Or did you see Due West, the first one, David?
I remember watching bits of it, not all of it. I don't have opinion on Due West. I didn't see enough to formulate one. But I think judging from Undercover Duet, I would be mildly interested in seeing what he's up to next. I think he's legitimately funny. I think there's some actual gags in this movie that's pretty funny. It made me laugh a lot.
Yeah, he's back and forth in 3D Sex and Sin with Tin Kai Man was quite memorable for a dark-ass movie, as we know. And that was a nice break playing the surgeons in that one.
Like I said, I don't think he's that intriguing as an actor, but I think he has the chops when it comes to writing and perhaps directing.
And furthermore, just out of because I'm interested, I don't think I've seen a movie with Ronald Cheng where he starred. It's just not something I pursued, not out of dislike or anything. But he's been going at it for a while as an actor, and as you alluded to, he's done both comedic and serious roles. So do you know, in a general sense, guys, if his popularity has always been great or was great and now on a downslide kind of thing? Because you track back to stuff between 2000 and 2010, and it seems like we had a couple of what seemed like high-profile releases starring Ronald, whether they were trying to shape him into something he did not like or not. So what's your general view of Ronald Cheng back then and maybe versus now, Paul?
I think most people who maybe overseas may not realize that he's been a celebrity for quite a long time before he really got into movies. He was a singer and he's got quite a few albums out. So he slowly made this transition into films, and then they kind of pushed him into this funny man role. And so we get some of the films like Dragon Loaded and what's the film that's the Zoolander ripoff?
Supermodel or Models?
Supermodel, yeah. And stuff like that, which I always enjoyed for the most part. I like his style of comedy. I like his humor. He started to become a little bit trapped in the sort of early Stephen Chow mode, where a lot of it became repetitions of the expressions and sort of facial reactions and things he became known for. And it was later that he started to be able to get offered some alternative roles, but that was when he was kind of his sort of comedic persona was starting to take a downward turn, and he had a series of a couple films that were not quite as popular at the box office. I'm thinking like around the time of movies like Mr. 3 Minutes and Himalaya Singh, Undercover Hidden Dragon, he just wasn't doing as well comedically. And so he started to shift over into some other roles. And one of the things I've always said about Ronald Cheng, I like him when he's doing comedy. I love him when he's doing martial arts. There's something about him that speaks to me as him doing martial roles and being a badass.
Is he a practitioner or just for movies?
I don't know, but go back to, if you get a chance to see, not a great film, but he's great in it, Fatal Contact. Mm-hmm. And he's really cool in it. And I want to see much more of that. We get glimpses of that in this film in a few moments. And he kind of does some aspect of that in the trilogy role that he has in The Four, Part 1, 2, and 3. But I really want to see more of him as sort of the maybe like a smiling swordsman kind of role, or a role where he's just the guy you don't mess with. Because I think he carries that. He's able to carry that really well when he's not just trying to be, you know, do the funny facial quirks and funny reactions. So here he's got this combination, because he's going around, he's dropping F-bombs everywhere. You know, he does kind of throw out the facial smiles and going for the gag reactions at times. But he has a few moments where he does do a little bit of martial arts, and he kind of evokes that a little bit of that badassery.
Yeah, I've always been a fan. I think I really got on board when I saw him in Vulgaria. I think he's absolutely hilarious in that movie. And I agree with Paul, like, he handles the action well, and I want to see him cast as a badass, like, either whether it's, you know, like a swordsman, like Paul said, or like a detective who's serious, but there could be like comedic aspects to him. Like, I find that he doesn't often get a chance to play like a real character. I think his characters are always defined by how funny they are. Like, and I would like to see him play a real character. He reminds me a lot like Nick Chung before he hit it big. Like, he's able to, you know, really be funny, but also bring like some seriousness to like the roles that he was portraying.
And clearly there's something brewing there that maybe time will tell. I mean, he's certainly not at the end of his career or anything, so maybe time will tell. And heck, he even directed once, even though it was a Lunar New Year movie, by judging by the release date. But he did direct It's a Wonderful Life in 2007, but I don't know how much of a sort of directing tour de force that was, or if it was just like line up all the celebrities and then release it. There it is. I haven't seen it, so I'm just sort of prejudging it here. But okay, guys, jump into the movie. What do you want to start discussing, Paul?
The biggest problem for me with this film is it has a fairly convoluted plot, even though the plot is technically rather simple, because it's just kind of this thing you hear in the news a lot over here. You know, super rich tycoon son gets involved in something, and then it becomes a question, did he really do it, or is somebody covering up for him? So you have this kind of plot device used as the framework for the whole movie. And then Mark Wu's character of James getting sucked up in this because he has the actual evidence, and he's trying to use that as leverage in his own best interest. He has this sister who has her retinas are slowly detaching, and so she needs eye surgery, and she's trying to do right by her. But at the same time, the accident that the tycoon's son was involved in killed another driver, and so that man's wife, like, her family is left destitute because, you know, her husband's dead and he can't work and provide for them now, and she has like an ailing granny. So it's got all these sort of traditional elements. At the same time, it's playing with a lot of the news media format over here. So there's quite a few cutaways to news clips of different reporters kind of reporting on this event in the style of things like Apple Daily. And for those who are familiar with Hong Kong media or Taiwan media, the Apple Daily kind of animations that they like to use now to reenact certain things. Yeah, so there's that aspect. In the middle of all this, you've got James, the Mark Wu's character, his desire to become a celebrity. He's basically works as an extra. They make reference to that he's actually on Michael Bay films, except they're not called Transformers, they're called Transformans, right? And so, you know, and he does this like imitation Transformer voice. And it's actually pretty good. I don't think I could get my voice to do it except when I'm like really sick or something. But he's trying to get a role on Trans Five Man, which is like the fifth one. I guess because he's got this leverage, so they arrange, the tycoon arranges for him to get the role. And they have this actor playing Michael Bay. Doesn't really look like Michael Bay, but...
And do triads beat him up in a movie as well?
No, but there are gangsters, and he didn't get beaten up.
Pushed him.
From what I remember, the story, they came over, they tried to, you know, shake him down, and the police quickly got involved. And
I would like to think you're not making a Transformers on our shores, buddy. Like, get out of here, punch.
If you've seen Transformers, you know they did, and you know it's not Hong Kong for the most part. not real Hong Kong anyway, if you've been here. But anyway, there's this whole thing of his kind of career arc, and then they get him involved in this thing called the Man of China, which is this cross between like The Voice, if you're familiar with that show, and basically Mr. Hong Kong, where they get all these like male hunks and they strip them down and girls soak them with water and stuff. Yeah. It's like this weird combination of those two shows.
It's a male
and
pageant.
It's a male pageant. That ends up, he gets on that somehow. And then Ronald Chang is basically his friend from like secondary school or high school or something. And so he's trying to, you know, use that relationship to get back into his life so he can actually convince him to turn the evidence over to the police. And so he's like following him around. They end up going to Shanghai for this Man of China thing. That whole section, I think, could have just been dumped. The whole thing that, you know, where they go, because it really has no bearing on anything later in the story. It was like, well, they're just going to go to Shanghai and shoot these scenes, and maybe that'll get them maybe more China time, I guess. I don't know.
Is it like individual skits akin to the old days in Hong Kong where they clearly were padding out the movie with unscripted padding? Where you?
I mean, it's not that cut and dry, because he does mention that, you know, he's trying to join this competition to get more exposure for himself and everything. So there's this lead in to him going there, and then they end up coming back to Hong Kong. But in the context of the whole story, you could kind of have just cut that out and had the story continue here in Hong Kong, really.
Yeah, I think it would have been okay if that part was left out. But I think it's also just a new director just trying to cram as much material in as he possibly can, and, you know, and not knowing when to just cut stuff out.
Yeah, I'd be happy if we reverted back to running times akin to the 30s and 40s, like hour-long movies. Sometimes I truly believe that you should do that. I mean, one example crops up, and maybe it's not the best example, but I'm not a big fan of the Marx Brothers, but, you know, two or three of the movies are genius, and I remember watching Duck Soup, and I think that was like an hour long. Brilliant. It was not just like a parade of gags, but it was clever as hell, and it didn't need to be longer. Some other Marx Brothers movies, man, do they go on. And that example still clearly exists in today's day and world, because I think there is a genuine sort of pressure across the different nations that you gotta get it up to 2 hours, like, because we want to rotate it at that length, and you gotta get it to 90 minutes, or you gotta get it down to 90 minutes, maybe, and then compromise the vision because we need to rotate the damn thing as much as we can. So I think, unfortunately, some directors are not fully in control of it all. Having said that, I don't know if Mark Wu was the one who insisted on, my art needs to be 2 hours in this case. So I'll leave that answered.
Yeah, I think it's a case of he just didn't know. Maybe he fell in love with his material a little too much, and he didn't know where he needed to trim. There's also a little bit of perhaps what we might call political correctness insensitivity at work here, because Ronald Cheng, I'd say in the first 15 to 20 minutes of the film, he's kind of in semi-blackface. He's got makeup on to make him look darker, and the rationale is he's from Harlem. Right.
Okay.
In the States. Yeah. And, you know, he's like lived there for a long time. He doesn't speak Cantonese very well. That's why he always breaks into Chinglish. And he swears a lot. He just, you know, swears like a storm. And so it's this idea that, okay, this is what Harlem culture is really like, I guess.
He also has dreadlocks.
Yeah, he has red dreadlocks in the beginning of the film. David mentioned Bulgaria. They do try to throw in a Bulgaria reference, albeit indirectly, with a dual role that he plays, where there's this gangster who's basically the gangster character from Bulgaria that he played, with the accent and everything, that pops up. They don't mention it by name, because I guess technically they can't, because it's not Mark Wu's film. But the idea is there, and in the promotional material for this, when it was actually playing in the cinema, one of the big things on the big cardboard standees was they were saying, you know, Ronald's character from Bulgaria meets kid the kid from Journey, Due West, Our Sex Journey, right? Oh. And so it was like these two classic characters, quote unquote classic, because, you know, these aren't old films we're talking about.
The classic characters from a week ago.
Yeah, coming together. But they're not really those characters, technically. I mean, they are different characters, and this isn't really connected to either of those films, other than the fact that it's the actors, you know, playing different roles. Beyond that, there's a lot of cameos for people who are cameo watchers. Not perhaps quite as many as you'd get in a New Year film, but pretty close. I mean, almost everybody who pops up on screen, you're going to recognize, you know, Tanky Teen, whose producer shows up, Jacqueline Chong, I think, Master So. They actually have two feng shui masters in this film, right? Master So, So Manfeng, is here as basically his boss. He's kind of funny if you like Master So. I'm not a big fan of him, and I don't think he's really very good at acting, because he's just not. But he's basically doing his shtick of, you know, fortune telling. He's this police constable who's all into fortune telling. Who's the other The lady who's very popular now. Do you remember her name, David? Yes. She shows up very, very briefly, in just a minor cameo. A lot of other cameos from TVB and just other films. Tony Ho is present. He has a somewhat significant role as well.
Is that like a like disruptive? Is that like a parade where they just stop the movie, or they sort of smoothly integrate the cameos? Like they come on and they go really quickly.
Mostly it's smooth. Mostly it's people playing characters. They're when they get to the Shanghai section, the Man of China. There's a couple people who are judges, and they're just basically being themselves, albeit a little bit over the top. Chrissy Chow shows up. Yeah. Playing herself in a scene, and it's a kind of funny scene, but it's also kind of annoying in a way, just because she's being herself and the nature of that scene. I don't want to necessarily spoil that scene. There's a Louis Koo lookalike.
I was about to say, is he? No.
it's I guess the real Louis was busy, doing Star Wars commercials. The lookalike, the only thing I can say about this guy is just uglier Louis Koo.
I'm sure he's trying his best.
Yeah, but when he puts on a pair of glasses, the resemblance is striking. The tan is right.
He's much smaller, I think, in physique. it's like he was gifted, but not enough. He's like gifted enough to be like the Vegas review Louis Koo. Nah, I'm being mean. They use him in a somewhat funny manner too.
Since there is a lull here, is it able to pick itself up and you were able to sort of start chuckling, smirking, laughing with the movie again? Like because sometimes when a movie hits a lull, it can be hard to sort of for it to argue that you should be on board again. Because sometimes you do get bored and you lose motivation to continue watching. So how does Mark Wu do in that area, David? Was there any laughs to be had all up till the end after some weaker sections?
There was enough laughs and enough action to sustain my attention to the end. It does have this meta aspect to it towards the end, which is, again, unnecessary. But I think it's also
Scooby-Doo ending?
Yeah, kind of. But just kind of to show how clever Mark Wu is as a writer, I think. I think he's trying to prove a point, or he's trying to, audition for future writing gigs.
Hey, Choi Hak, you did that thing, I did that thing, we should work together.
I would say it probably works a little bit better in Undercover Duet than it does in Tiger Mountain. One for Mark Wu, I guess.
The part of the problem with this is I think there's three places where the film would end traditionally. And one of these, so after they kind of come back from Shanghai, the plot thickens, it picks up again, a couple things happen, and there's a big sort of very traditional Hong Kong cinema style showdown at a construction site that's actually well done. There's this killer, he's a very sort of one-dimensional, over-the-top hitman, not quite to the extent of like, say, a run-and-kill level, but something in that vein where it's very much just the sort of one track mind for this killer at this point in the movie. And there's even a scene where it's a weird scene. It's the scene where the killer is just something's happened to him and now he's just lost it, right? And so he's in his little rundown Hong Kong cubby of a home that's like totally trashed. It's like totally, it's like the worst dirt bag little room you could rent. He's got a punching bag hanging in the middle of it. He's stripped down because you want to see his muscles and everything. He's got quite the physique and he's very lean. He's got like 0.5% body fat and he's like going to town on this. And then in one scene, he's completely naked. They're doing sort of an Austin Powers kind of block shot and he's taking a piss in the room, right? And he's like screaming at the top of his lungs because he's this is the rage montage. You've seen this before, where the bad guy, the antagonist, he's so ticked off and he's just rah! He's like beating his bag, and the next thing he's just pissing in the room.
That's a new angle to this thing.
Funny.
Like,
kudos
to you, Mark Wu, for the, you know, defying expectations, kind of like, you've seen a rage montage. Well, we're gonna have our guy pee as well. What do you think about that?
Yeah. It's like I've got to take time out of the day to pee. But he's peeing while in rage mode. You know, yeah. It's not like it suddenly cuts to elevator music. It's full on rage throughout the montage.
That would have been funny too if it like literally calmed down for like 30 seconds.
As if his rage stops for nothing.
Yes, indeed. but they get to this construction site, and you know, it's a very sort of very, again, traditional 90s-esque style scene where there's reversals of fortune at times between the protagonists and antagonists. And it gets to this point where you're kind of like, okay, this is where a 90s movie would have just, done a freeze frame, roll credits or something. But no, you look at the time code and you realize there's still 20 more minutes of this movie left.
Really?
And so it goes on, and then, you know, a little bit more exposition. I think they go into the courtroom, and courtroom. Okay, so that there's going to be some time spent there. And
then it becomes a courtroom drama for a little bit.
Courtroom drama, and then post-courtroom scene, right? Post-courtroom scene that you've seen before. And here again, another place where a 90s movie would have just ended the film. And no, it goes on yet again. And then he pulls this kind of, Scooby-Doo rabbit out of his hat, as David alluded to. And we get to the true ending of the film. And even then, it goes on into the credits and is making the commentary that, hey, movies like Iron Man and those Marvel films, they always have stuff after the credits. And he's like, well, we're not Hollywood, so we're just going to do our own thing. But they basically have a cutscene that runs. It's part of the film, and it runs. It's not an outtake. It runs the length of the credits right to the very last one.
Yeah, it seems like it's packed and maybe a bit too packed. I mean, the playful nature, the vibe that I'm getting from your discussion, the playful nature of it doesn't sound ill-conceived, but it's like you sort of alluded to, David, that maybe Mark Wu is fearful of never getting this stuff in a movie. So why not get it into this one movie? And that can be a big, big red flag for a movie if it's too packed. I mean, I'm used to Hong Kong cinema throughout the ages just switching left and right in terms of moods, darkness, love, musicals, wacky comedy, and then a super dark ending freeze frame during the most tragic moments of the ending, and then the movie's over. Like, I'm all used to that, but it sounds like it overextends that that way of thinking.
And he's also co-starring in it too, right? So, I mean, it might be even more difficult for someone to cut themselves out of a movie.
Yeah, that's the thing that time will tell. If Mark Wu does indeed do his Duest 2 or other movies, if there's a learning curve. Because learning curve can last many movies if you're allowed to make many movies. And there's nothing wrong with that. But you need to show some learning curve. Does sound easy enough for a two-sitting kind of dealio, maybe. So that's my interpretation of it all. Like, it sounds good fun. I mean, when it does, like, feature action and stuff like that, is it still leaning towards the comedic? Or does it argue that, this is deadly serious right now. That guy got shot.
It does try to have a couple of melodramatic moments. It doesn't get too... It never really gets into our true realm of darkness, but there are moments of where you are overly concerned for characters, and you can see that characters are being affected by events. It's not cartoon violence in that sense.
Yeah, the action is not overly slapstick.
Yeah, because you never know with these kind of things if they want to keep it to that mood or not. And certainly with 90s and 80s Hong Kong cinema, when action hit, you could have either or sometimes. It could really do a switcheroo on you, which I more than often enjoyed as these things go. I have a slight feeling that this wasn't like plastered all over all the billboards in town when it played, Paul, or how was this sort of feeling end of August when this came out last year?
They were trying to really push it. Again, they were trying to sell it on the sort of post-Vulgaria and post-Due West vibes, I guess. And I'm ultimately surprised in part that this is a category 2B film.
Mm-hmm.
There's no nudity. I mean, there's sort of normal level martial arts violence for a standard, you know, 90s action movie. A little bit of blood in a couple places, you know, like a couple scenes, but nothing, no gore to speak about of any kind. But just the amount, the sheer amount of F-bombs that Ronald Chang lays throughout the movie from start to finish, but it points to the nature of foreign foul language and the weight of foreign foul language versus native Cantonese foul language, right? Because you can get a movie like Vulgaria, which has no actual nudity.
Despite it being about remaking a nudie film. Wow.
The coarsest moment that you really get is implied oral sex, I think. And then you have, what's her name, braless in one scene. The actress who's name popping shocking candy or whatever. I can't remember her name.
Oh, yeah, Dada.
Dada Chen, excuse me.
Dear Lord.
Yeah. But for the most part, that's a movie that's all about Cantonese vulgarity in terms of language. And so here you have them use a little bit of Cantonese vulgarity, just enough to keep it within the 2B rating. But English vulgarity just all over the place. Whereas if you were to throw this over to the, you know, American censors, this would probably definitely be an R film just for language alone. It's interesting to see that dynamic. And I've noticed it tier two culturally a couple of times, because you'll see people wearing T-shirts with like the F word on it, or the, you know, the SH word on it. And it's, you know, they're just like old grannies walking around with
this stuff. Yes, awesome.
It's you know, because it's like they don't have a sense of the weight and the context. It's just, oh, that's a funny English word. You know, the equivalent is, you know, me going and, you know, wearing a shirt in the U.S. with foul language Chinese. Nobody in the U.S. is going to know. They're not going to care. I've seen a couple TV programs, like, I can't remember what come to mind, but where people are like actually using like Cantonese foul language on, you know, mainstream television, and, you know, it's not going to get bleeped or censored because nobody knows about it, right? Nobody understands it, except the Cantonese speaker. So
you would think it would be a hipster thing, you know, like a hipster would walk around with F-bombs on his shirt, but the grannies do it, the oblivious do it or not. That's really endearing. I like that.
It's just the liberal use of that kind of it takes me aback, because again, it's I look at it from my American sensibility and going, wow, you know, but it's still funny. I mean, when he does it, you know, he makes it work. He makes it funny. If you like Ronald Chang, you'll find it funny. If you don't care for Ronald Chang, you'll probably find it a little bit laborious.
Was he ever in his comedic style? Did he ever try to define a comedic style by being very verbal with his comedy, or very physical with his comedy? Or it never really had you could never really slot him into a thing like you could with Stephen Chow for a while, where it was sometimes very verbal based.
You know, I'm just thinking back to when he really started to pick up around the time of My Lucky Star, which I think, you know, around 2003, and then he starts to get his own solo vehicles with Dragon Loaded and Supermodel. Yeah, right around that time. I mean, his style was, again, kind of just based on characterizations of his face and the way he would laugh or the way he would smile. And I think people got tired of that fairly quickly, a lot quicker than they did of, you know, sort of Stephen Chow's facial reactions where he'd stick out his tongue and do that kind of thing, or the back and forth that he'd have with sort of Mantat over several films. For the most part, Ronald was by himself. He really didn't always have the same person to play off of. So it really would come down a lot to who his co-star was. So some films work better than others, I would say.
Yeah, I'm sure I've encountered him in like four or five movies without knowing it as such. But I think the one that it's been a long while since I watched it, but I do remember the movie and liked the movie. But that was purely a dramatic performance, a supporting one in Mr. Cinema, the Anthony Wong movie. I think it was the girlfriend of the Anthony Wong's daughter. Was it Karen Mok in that movie? Girlfriend, for heaven's sake. The boyfriend of Karen Mok, yeah. But that was just, you know, him acting as a guy. You know, a perfectly suitable performance and all of that. So he proved that he could sort of escape any any comedic persona quite easily, because I knew of, you know, that's a comedic actor, Ronald Cheng. I mean, that's an English name I can remember because it's an actual English name and not a sound. Da da.
Yes.
Like, I can just, you know, change my English name to blah blah. You know, that's doable, apparently, in the entertainment circles, you know.
No, if you come over here, you got to be BB. You'll be Kenny BB. So then everybody will know you're different.
I'll kill myself if it turns into
Kenny
that.
Kenny BB.
Anything else you want to mention, David, from the movie?
No, I think that's it. Watch it. It's good.
I think that if Mark Wu, if this is indicative on his second film, you know, his sophomore film, of the kind of stuff that he can do and he can grow from this, I think he's got a pretty strong future in doing, you know, Hong Kong comedy. So,
oh, actually, I had a question for Paul. How does this movie compare to House of Wolves?
I think I like this one better.
Really?
I was a bit disappointed with House of Wolves. It seemed to have a lot of promise, but then pretty much the best parts of the movie are what you see in the trailer, and there's not a lot beyond that.
Are they similar in any way? Because I know House of Wolves is the Francis movie where he's all buff and tattooed on a poster.
Yeah, no, that has nothing to do with anything in the movie. It's a great Photoshop job that they do on the two of them. And there's nothing in the movie of that at all. There's no, they don't pretend to dress up in like muscle men. They don't take a drug and get pumped up or anything. It's just something they did for the posters for some reason. The film was marketed as this big sort of over the top vulgar thing. And it's not vulgar at all. I mean, it's very tame. It's, you know, not technically a New Year's movie, but they kind of pushed it into that early window. And so the poster campaigns, you know, they're all red and colored and make it look like a kind of a New Year's film. It's just, yeah, it's a bit disappointing, I think, just because it's not anywhere near what they kind of marketed.
Oh, Ronald was in it as well. Okay, now I sort of saw the connection there. And then, for heaven's sake, it was only category 2A. So, you know, where's the vulgarity within 2A?
And I think that's Vincent Koch, directorial effort, if I'm remembering the director correctly. So, you know, he has a long history with doing Ronald in some of the early films, and I think he used them a lot better early on, I think, than he's done here.
Yeah, availability, I did check, I believe, that it was out on DVD and Blu-ray and VCD for Hong Kong, so you can get it, obviously, English subtitled. It might be region locked to Hong Kong's region, which is A, I believe. Not only Hong Kong's a region, but it is one of the countries that has a region A. But you can get it, and it's all reasonably priced. So, again, for once, I always emphasize this. It's nice to talk of available movies for once on this show, whether it's the Dynasty Report or E or any show that talks of a vintage known movie, super-duper classic, but it's not available. You know, it's sort of deflating sometimes to talk of recognizable classics that sort of needs to have a podcast discussion, and they were out on DVD and now they're just gone, and it sort of deflates me that it's a shame that you can't lead people easily to availability. In the case of Tiger Mountain and Undercover Duet, you should assume they are available, but as we've learned, the release window is sort of unpredictable for movies, even local ones, that it can be out quick and it can take a long ass time before it's out for whatever reason. In this case, I don't know if it appeared quickly or not, but it is out. So next time, maybe, you know, we will have hit the release window for video of the proposed From Vegas to Macau 3 discussion. Yeah, because I don't know, do you remember if 1 and 2 came out fairly quickly on video, or did it take a long ass time for them to arrive as well?
No, they were pretty quick within the first half of the year. So.
Yeah, so you would assume, because even though I've heard you guys talk of this might not have been the biggest hit of the series, Hong Kong and mainland combined, it's still that series. They're not going to sit on it for 6 months before it gets a disc release.
Yeah, no, and especially because there was a whole boycott thing that we'll perhaps talk about as well. I think they might be wanting to make up some revenue, perhaps.
I don't think I'll be available for that discussion, guys.
That's okay. That's okay. Paul is glad to sit through it again on video and make extensive notes, and I'll listen and we'll decide even now.
David, we should Andy Lau, David, Jackie Chan, yeah, David.
Yeah, but he's also wearing a wig, though. Like, will you watch it, Ken? Will you watch it?
Absolutely not. Of course not. I've seen one. That was enough for me.
Maybe what we need to do is we need to do it as a commentary episode.
With knives at the ready, just to sort of cut ourselves. Like, I don't like this. I hate this. I hate this. I hate this. Yeah. I mean, I've heard your little quick bite-sized review. You didn't do it on East Screen, West Screen, but it was kind of sad, though. You would hope that, not the review, but you would hope that when you got these guys together, that, you know, been around for decades and defined so much and so well, that they would make some kind of effort. And it sounded like, nah, not at all. We paid them and that's all the effort. Is that fair, Paul, without doing a full review now? That
I just don't know if you can actually apply the word fair at all to this movie. It's just the completely wrong term to use in talking about anything to do with this film.
I would love for the movie to end with Wong Jing at the tail end of the credits, because he's so cocksure about its commercial appeal. We'll turn up at the end looking at the screen like, see you next year. Do you think there will be a fourth one?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't paid any attention to the mainland box office, and that's going to be the sole determinant of the yay or nay.
Let's just say the prospect that sounded awesome from the beginning, that they get Andy Lau in the actual movie this time, not a cameo appearance, and Jackie Chung and others, Karina Lau or what have you, it sounded like it died out pretty quickly, that excitement, you know. Frame one or frame two, I don't know. But
I just long for the day when our beloved Kenny B or Kenny BB has no run bets. Out of sleaze and
nope.
and
no, no,
Hong
no.
Kong and ninja movies, and nope. he has nothing left to watch.
Nope.
Except
yeah. I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. It'll have to be a darkened van kidnapping scheme. Like, I'm not gonna do it. One was enough, and in retrospect, maybe From Vegas to Macau, one is a work of genius by now. Comparatively, I don't know, but it didn't do anything for me. If it has not come out on video by the time we think we're closing in on recording another one, we'll think of something else to sort of bring up. Because Undercover Duet is was a great, great choice to bring up to make me aware, and also listeners, that it seems like a fairly fun Hong Kong action comedy is out there, and so yeah, there's always new efforts to talk of. But in the meantime, we're gonna run through the contact information again, and this has been the Dynasty Report within Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire network. We are on podcastonfire.com, along with bonus episodes and all the other choices you can make in terms of if you want to listen to our Korean cinema show, or Japanese cinema show, or sleazy show. And if you have any feedback, let us know what you thought of From Vegas to Macau 3 if you watched it. Maybe don't write, but illustrate it with angry symbols that replaces the cursing instead. You know, like they did in old comic books or comic strips. Like, instead of people having cursing, they had like images of knives and bombs instead. So do that. Be creative. But anyway, podcastonfire@googlemail.com is our email address. Follow the links on the top of our website to our various social media, Facebook page and Facebook discussion group, our Twitter. And you can find our link to our iTunes feed as well as our Stitcher feed if you don't want to download podcasts. And I write about that. Actually, did I review From Vegas to Macau 1? I might have. I don't remember now, but in that case, in quick bite fashion. Oh yeah, I did. Now I remember, I did. And but I'm not gonna do the other ones over at SoGoodReviews.com and SleazyKVideo.com is my video hub, so there won't be any video review as well. And my Twitter handle is @SoGoodReviews. I wonder though, will there be any gambling craze sort of spin-off dealio From Vegas to Macau 3, whether headed by Wong Jing or not? Because sometimes, I think one of you guys talked about it, so sometimes that happens, like something takes off, other filmmakers take it upon themselves to cash in on that, but I don't think anyone has sort of done gambling movies too. Or what do you remember from the last 2 years' output from Hong Kong?
There's a couple smaller offshoots like There's a Hong Kong-Singapore collaboration with Chapman Toe and I think Roger Kwok and Mark Lee from Singapore called, I think it's King of Mahjong, or that was last year. Smalls piece, kind of, you know, just very hitting the beats of things like better movies like Fa Choi Spirit and things more than anything else. Mr. and Mrs. Gambler from a few years back with Chapman Toe as well. So, you know, small films here and there, but not, you know, nothing that's really, you know, like the old gambling craze. Part of it's because there's been a crackdown in Macau by the mainland government.
Huh. In what way?
Well, gambling is bad.
Okay. Right. But it is legal in Macau, though.
It is legal, but it's also bad. And this is why, and I think Ko's...
That's rational. That's very rational.
Gambling's bad. Point,
yeah. It's the same thing with prostitution, right? There is no prostitution in China, except there is, right? You know, that's why you have movies like Due West. Kozo pointed this out, right? With the Vegas to Macau movies, the gambling that they do is always for charity now. And this goes back to the very first one, right? Everything, all these big high stakes, it's always got to be for charity. Otherwise, well, that's a big no-no. And the censors, you know, Bureau Sarft or whoever, whatever their long anagram name is now, they, you know, won't accept it because gambling's bad. But still, that, you know, they've got lots of big, rich mainland party members who will go and gamble in Macau. But there was a big crackdown either last year or late in 2014 where they cracked down on a couple of the big casinos and like a big, you know, money laundering kind of ring thing. And so Macau's lost a lot of business in the past 2 years, I think. And it's been pretty big news over here because, you know, a lot of people, they have jobs that are not directly in the gambling business. I mean, you've got local tycoons who are, you know, have casinos over there, but you have people who have jobs or things that are tied as offshoots, and they have family members in Macau who are working in some way, shape, or form for the casinos indirectly. And so when business is bad there, it's kind of big news here.
Well, quick plug for your podcast as well, Paul. What's it called and where are you on the web?
Yeah, you can find us at East Screen, West Screen, and just head over to Kongcast.com. That's KONGCAST.com. And you'll find the postings there or on relative Facebook things and social media whatnots.
Recent news, recent movies, and check Paul's podcast. Check it out because of that, because he does a damn fine job along with his co-host, Kevin Ma.
Lots and lots of inspiration from our very own Kenny B right here.
Yeah, that's right. Kenny B and not Kenny BB. There it is. Okay, we are done. So I've been Kenny B. Learn it, know it, love it. And I've been with Paul Fox, so say bye, buddy.
Goodbye.
And Dr. David Lam, so you're going to send us out, buddy.
Until next time, everybody. Until next time.
This has been The Doctor. I still like that. I'm disappointed you don't use that more often. I like that. That was a great sign off inspiration. This has been The Doctor.
I will do it next time, Ken, just for you.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
He's no longer the doctor of, you know, what was it on the This Week in Sleaze episode?
Dictor. Believe me, I remember that stuff. It's not inspired comedy, but I do remember that. Hey, I made it funny.